this is episode 2 of the Movies You Love podcast. It's the podcast where I get the chance to sit down and talk to some very interesting people all across the internet all about the movies they love, the movies that help them fall in love with movies. And this week, we go all the way out to Australia where I get to hang out with Mr. Tom Clift. I didn't go to Australia. We do this thing over the internet. You know, it's fun that way. Mr. Tom Clift, who he writes for his own blog, reviewsbytom.blogspot.com, which is movie reviews by Tom Clift, but he also writes primarily for moviedex.com as well as the moviemezzanine.com, which is actually moviemezzanine.com. You don't put the in the URL. But regardless, he wanted to sit down and talk all about Mr. Christopher Nolan and all about Memento, and these are two things which I all agree with. Like, I love Chris Nolan. I've always said that Memento is my favorite of his films, but you know, we get into so much about the progression of Christopher Nolan's filmography, the fact that he has become synonymous with the interesting blockbuster, and how that's so great for the for Hollywood on a whole. And so why am I spoiling the podcast for you? Why don't you just just sit down, be patient, it's about to come right now, go. And by the way, guys, this podcast, the iTunes feed is up now, so go search for it in iTunes. You can just search for my name, Andrew Robinson. You can search for Movies You Love Podcast, it should come up. If not, there's a link in the post here. Go subscribe, go vote, go rate, go give it a review. I don't even care if you give it a bad review. I'll love you if you give it a bad review. I'll love you even more if you give it a good review, because we're all about movie, we're all about things we love. Go and do that, guys, because this podcast, I really want this to be a big project and I want everyone to love it. So go and do that. But anyways,
I have this condition.
A condition?
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No, it's different from that. Since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades. If we talk for too long, I'll forget how we started. Next time I see you, I'm not going to remember this conversation.
What's the last thing that you do remember?
My wife.
That's sweet.
Dying.
All right, so the movie this week that you asked for us to talk about is Christopher Nolan's Memento, his follow-up to following his student film. The movie was first released in 2000. Can I ask you, when was the first time you actually saw this movie, and what were the circumstances around it?
I would have to guess that the first time I saw this would have been in 2000 and probably 2005. And I saw it on DVD. And it was just after, and I think we know a few people whose kind of love of films really start this way. But for my 14th birthday, I was given a book voucher, and I went out and bought the book 1001 Movies You Have to See Before You Die. And Memento was amongst the films listed in this book, and so I really think I was just kind of flicking through it at random. Happened to go to the video store, happened to see a title that I recognized from this book, and I said, oh, I should check this out. And I sat down and watched it, and I remember thinking about halfway through it that it was I just turned 14. I was thinking, this is the greatest film that I've ever seen. So that was my initial exposure to it.
You talk about the 1001 Films book, which I have a list of on my site. It's something that I kind of use as a guideline as to some movies that I should expose myself to that I haven't seen yet. But how is it that do you still use that book as your own guideline for movies that you want to see, that you want to expose yourself to?
I mean, I don't think I've ever really been so reliant on it that I'm like, all right, well, I don't keep track of how many I've seen, for example. But certainly I think that that book was extremely formative in terms of my knowledge and my appreciation of films, and that, you know, it taught me a lot about film history, taught me a lot about these important films, films I'd already seen, films I have subsequently seen, and films that I still am really, really I really want to see. I've still kind of got, I don't make it a mission to go get through it necessarily, but it's definitely played a big part.
Talking about Memento, a film which uses a broken narrative to some extent, telling us these two storylines which go backwards and forwards respectively. One of him finding out who his wife's killer was, and one being him discussing his life as to how he experiences it in the hotel room on the phone. How is it that you experience this movie, in what that you actually focus more on? Do you find that you look towards one storyline more than the other, or you actually watch them, you actually focused simultaneously, kind of pairing them against each other?
I think that, look, I've seen the film at least 10 times. And I think the first time that I watched it, certainly, I was just so floored by the concept of not even necessarily a film that was non-linear, because I'd experienced that before. But I think a film that where the narrative structure really reflected a narrative element, in the sense that the thing that is, I think, so brilliant about the structure of Memento is that you experience the narrative in some ways in the same way that the character does, and that you never know what just happened because you were seeing the scenes backwards. And I just think, so the first time I saw it, I was just so floored by that. I think perhaps it's the murder investigation narrative that is more immediately, there's more driving that along, if you know, which is ironic because it's kind of going backwards. But there's certainly, I think, more pacing to that, whereas the black and white sequences are more kind of noirish slower moving. I certainly don't know that there's one that I think is more important. I mean, I think they're both essential, and I think they're both fascinating to watch. And I think that, again, the way that it's structured, you have all these mini cliffhangers in the film, which is really another great way of keeping you compelled. So I think that, yeah, I don't know. Does that answer your question?
I guess, but one thing I noticed, and because I rewatched this film earlier today, actually, I was trying to watch it last night, and sadly, I made the decision to do this at 2 a.m. Don't do that, children. You'll just fall asleep. The movie during the narrative of him finding his wife's killer, the sequences that are in color that go backwards, you have this moment at the end of every one of those scenes where they try to remind us that we're leading up to what we saw last. And while this is something which I feel is essential, just for the sake of the audience going, guys, we're not trying to lose you here, we're trying to catch you up, do you ever get a feeling that it doesn't need to do that after like the second or third time that we've come to understand this language of the film?
Oh yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and I can certainly see that. I mean, I do remember, again, going back to that first viewing, for the first, like, say, 4 scenes, just being, what the hell is going on? And then you'll come to understand what it is, and from that point, you're kind of like, ah, it's, you know, this is brilliant. I don't know. It's never bothered me. I can see how it might if you start to feel that it's just kind of repeating needless information. But I don't know. Sometimes I feel like those extra bits, are very important, in that once you've seen what came before, they actually, mean very different things. And once they're in context, you have a greater understanding of what that additional, that repeated information is. So a perfect example is, when he's rummaging, it's the scene right before, or the scene where he is goaded into hitting
Carrie-Anne Moss,
thank you. And you see him, the first time you see him, like, rummaging for a pen, and you don't know what he's trying to write down, and then she comes in, and you, and then the scene goes on. But then when you see the scene where he hits her, and then you see him rummaging for a pen to remind himself what happened, and he doesn't get to, all of a sudden, you kind of, I don't know, that just provides you with a greater understanding. And there are a few moments like that throughout the film that, I don't know, I think that those little bits of repetition can be quite dramatically powerful.
Yeah, and specifically with that scene, I think what hit me, and for some reason, I know it's quite obvious in the movie, but for some reason, I don't think I actually noticed this until like the third time I saw this movie, where when that the context for him rummaging for the pen comes around, where he actually hits her and she leaves to come back. You see at the beginning of that one that you see her before she even starts to piss him off. She's just picking up every pen she can find and throwing it in her bag.
Exactly.
which just goes like, oh, that colors her in such a bad way. It makes you understand that this isn't something that she thought up on the fly. She came in with this distinct intention.
I know, and that's something, that's another reason why the film is so good, I think, is because it offers itself to so many repeat viewings where you notice tiny little things like that. And, you know, especially the second time you watch it and you understand, you kind of, maybe not the second time, maybe it takes till the third or fourth time, where you have a full understanding of everyone's motivations throughout the film, and you can appreciate, you know, why, for example, she helps him at the beginning of the film. Which is, of course, the end of the plot. And then you kind of see, well, it's because she was feeling bad because of this, or, you know, it's just, I don't know, I think there's just so much that structure offers the film.
Actually, that's one thing that I noticed today watching the movie, thinking about other people's motivations. And you can tell me about how you feel in this, but for some reason, when I watch a lot of films like this, I feel so focused on the protagonist for us, Leonard, this time around, that I kind of only see all the ancillary characters as people who influence the protagonist, as opposed to talking about these ancillary characters. I was reading a couple posts, and I saw someone clip an interview with Joey Pantoliano talking about his character for the film. And he brought up the fact that his entire motivation for the movie is to get the car away from Leonard. Right? And you kind of see little bits where he kind of tries to tell Leonard, you know, I can do something with this car. I can fix the window. I can take it around to my friend and get it cleaned, where he's just trying to get it away from him. And it just came off so weird for me at that point. Like, I had never thought about that.
And I think that's really interesting because, I mean, obviously, and again, that works really well because throughout the film, he's trying to get the car and you're like, it's just kind of like a funny kind of gag. You know, he's like, he's being a sleaze as the character tends to be. But then, of course, you realize that there's all this money in the boot of the car. And I think that I've always heard the, you know, why doesn't he just steal the car? And I think there are moments in the film that I don't think the film is perfect. I think there are holes that can be poked into it. But I think that, yeah, there is a lot there and just stuff like why, you know, I mean, I love the Joey Pantoliano character, you know, is he Lenny's friend? Is he totally manipulating him? Is a little bit of both, you know, when the revelations come at the end, how much of that is true? Isn't it true? It's really, I don't know. There's obviously a lot of ambiguity there, but in such a way that you can actually interpret. I don't know. I just think that there's so much to be found, just in reading what each character is up to. And you can watch the film you can focus on a different character and treat almost them like they're the protagonist and have a very different experience with the film. And I mean, I think Leonard, you really root for him. And I think Guy Pearce's performance is fantastic, but he's really not a very, you know, nice person. He does some pretty awful things, and can be pretty selfish. So I think that, yeah, it's very much like a noir, in terms of that kind of ambiguity.
One of the elements of this film, which I've always kind of honed in on, was how Nolan's ability is to make this movie more or less like a puzzle, where we're struggling to find more pieces to fit in to get the bigger picture. I mean, we've seen him do with this with Following, as well as with Inception, or even The Prestige. Where do you see this film falling in line with his canon? There's a big discussion always going on about his canon as to his films all fitting in into one reality, which I think is a bunch of garbage mostly. But, I mean, there is discussion, but, eh.
I think in terms of his filmography, I think that he has a pretty clear style, both visually and in terms of the narratives of his films. I think that it's interesting. I think Following was one of the last films of his that I saw, because it's not as widely available as some of his others. And if you watch Following, I think it's so telling. Like, I think Following is not a great film. It feels very much like a student film. It feels cheap. It's a little bit clumsy. But there is so much in Following that you just know it's a Nolan film, from, you know, the black and white, the kind of tortured loner of a protagonist, the, you know, the nonlinear, this noirish influence. And I think that every one of his films certainly have some or all of those characteristics. I mean, they're almost all told out of order, often in a way that is essential to the actual plot. He tends to focus on these characters who suffered a trauma and are looking for a way to rectify what has happened to them, or come to terms with what has happened to them. So I definitely think that Following, and then again with Memento, they're both very much prototypes for what would come later.
So do you feel that these being prototypes, that his later films actually show the improvement? Do you feel that the likes of Inception is actually builds on what he's creating here in Following and Memento?
I think that for me, Memento is my favorite Nolan film. I think it will probably always be my favorite Nolan film, but I think a large part of that is that the fact that it was a very formative film to me, and that it really got me into films, and it was the first film that made me consider that film could be so much more than just a, you know, entertainment. But definitely I think you see progression and development in his later films. I mean, obviously they get bigger budget, they look glossier. I think Inception and then The Dark Knight Rises probably represent the peak of his technical prowess. Some of, I think, the use of editing and the cinematography in Inception and Dark Knight Rises, editing can be Nolan's greatest strength and his greatest weakness. Oftentimes he edits it to shit and you can't tell what's going on, and it creates problems with the continuity. But for example, the way he would cut between dream levels in Inception to create this sense of pace and build up. And I think the same, for example, in the montage in The Dark Knight Rises, where Bane is standing on the steps delivering this speech, and you see everything that he is saying coming to pass while Bruce Wayne watches from the prison. I think that there is, you see really his use of editing there. Like in Memento was kind of this very like, I mean, obviously editing is essential for Memento, but it would be like one scene and then you'd cut to another and then another in this back and forth kind of way that would slowly build up a pace. And I think you see that in his other films. And then I think also, the characters, as I said, there are certainly similarities. I know a lot of people look to The Prestige as their favorite Nolan film, and that they think the structure and the back and forth between these two men, these two magicians, is really one of the best things he's ever done. I don't know. I think that certainly, I think he took what he learned in Memento and some of the ideas he had in Memento and perhaps made them more, I guess, subtle in his other films. I don't know. I think you can look at every one of his films, and especially his earlier films, and see the direct influence on his later films.
One of the things that I was looking at, strangely enough, in this movie, rewatching it, was Leonard's tattoos. There's some which are obviously just statements of character building. You see the tattoo on his collarbone reminding him that his wife was raped and killed, the facts on his arm and his thighs. But there was one which kind of bothered me, and I don't know if you've ever really thought about it. One that we see on his abs, his core, which is facing him upside down, which is this little, I don't even know what to call it, a pyramid of things. It goes.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
Yeah, photograph, house, car, friend, and foe, with foe pointing at him. I've not been able to really find anything online of anyone trying to figure out what this really refers to, but for me, when I was looking at it today, watching Leonard discuss things like how memory can be always tainted and how he understands that he can be his own worst enemy, is this him reminding himself that he's not supposed to be even trusting himself?
I mean, I'm not sure. I think that probably is it. I think that, I mean, not all of the tattoos are, you know, specifically addressed in the film, but to me, I guess those words represent pretty much the most important things in Leonard's life, and pretty much all he has. I mean, what is it? It's home. He barely has a home, but photograph. He has to remember to take photographs of things. That is, you know, the number one thing that he has to do. You know, the car is so important to him, and that's how he, I mean, without his car, so much of the time the film is spent in the car, or because that's literally all he does. He has this obsession. I think the faux tattoo, yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know. Perhaps that is what Nolan is trying to say that Leonard is trying to remind himself of. Yeah, I don't know. I've never really thought about that particular tattoo. But, I mean, certainly, I don't know. You wonder. I mean, the film always talks about repetition and teaching yourself to know things, and I wonder if, you know, every time Leonard sees those tattoos, is that the first time he remembers having them, or has he slowly conditioned himself to remember that they're there? And if so, is that there to remind him of that? I don't know.
I want to get closer to the end of this movie to discuss a couple of the things that we find out in the reveal, to deal with Leonard, and specifically with the story of Sammy Jenkins. There are a lot of small things that end up coming in where we see the story of Sammy Jenkins. We see him in the mental institution, and there's almost a half of a second shot.
Yeah.
Where you see an orderly or a nurse walk past Sammy Jenkins, and it turns into Leonard sitting in that same chair. We then hear about Joe Pantoliano, Teddy, telling him that he's been mixing these stories this whole time. Nolan has always talked about all of his films where people always ask him, what does this mean? And he refuses to answer the question. He allows his movies to lie within ambiguity.
Yeah.
Therefore leaving the viewer to decide and to ultimately make opinion into fact as to what the movie is actually telling you. Do you ever feel that the movie purposefully lies to us towards the end? Is it asking us to pick a side, or is it asking us to just not care as to whether he's gotten his revenge or not?
I don't know. I don't think that the movie lies, because I think that the movie, I mean, the movie is 100% from Leonard's point of view. You know, I mean, are there any scenes in them without him? I don't think so.
No, every scene is with him.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, I mean, he is the definition of an unreliable narrator. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know his own history. And so I think that anytime we get a flashback, and I think of that moment where his wife, where Joey tells him that his wife was diabetic. And throughout the film, we've seen this memory of him a couple of times of him pinching his wife's thigh. And it's just totally out of context, and it looks just like a nice little moment between them. And then at that moment when he finds about that she was diabetic, we flash to that same image, but it's him giving her insulin shot. And then he seems to be struggling with it, and then we get that memory again without the needle. So, and that's the last we see of it. And so is it this thing of, is Joey lying? Or which one of those two memories is the right one? Is him remembering a needle just there because Joey has put that thought in his head? Or is that actually what's happened? And is he trying to forget it by conditioning himself with this other memory? So I don't think that Nolan ever cheats us in the sense that I don't think where he as the kind of omniscient director is giving us misleading information, but I do think that there's probably plenty that we see in the film in the flashbacks that isn't real. But I think that is a legitimately something that Leonard remembers, whether or not, you know, it actually happened or whether it's something that has been twisted by him. I think is certainly possible.
I mean, there's even one, you definitely can't call it a flashback because there's no way that it could exist in reality. One image that we're given at the end of the movie when he's driving away and he's saying that he wants to believe that when he closes his eyes, that world is still there. We see this image of him laying with his wife with all of his tattoos on. And there's a tattoo at his heart, the space that he said is left for when he gets his revenge, which says, I did it. So at that point, we're given that image. Is that image supposed to make us know that, as you're saying, all of these other flashbacks we've been seeing, possibly not all or even any of them could be true?
I mean, I certainly think that that is some one way you can interpret it. And again, that's why I like this film and I love all of Nolan's films, is that you can interpret them in so many different ways. Yeah, I definitely think that that's a possibility, and I definitely think that it's possible that he's hinting at that. And I think that that scene to me is so, so tragic. It's such an emotional image because it's this peace that he wants so desperately to achieve, and it's this happiness that you want so badly for this character that obviously he can't achieve because he's never going to get his wife back, no matter how long he looks, no matter how many people he potentially kills, he's never getting her back. So he's never going to get that perfect memory, I guess. But I think even more tragic is that in some ways he's cheating himself of it. Because if what Joey's character says is true, if he has been going from town to town, killing all these different John G's, you know, he's denying himself of that catharsis, of the chance to ever get that final tattoo, because he knows kind of deep down that without this mission, he would be totally lost.
So just because I always like to know, how people actually view films and how, because one of the things with pretty much every film is you can have a cynical or an optimistic view as to how it ends. When this ending comes, and I mainly ask this because now that he's actually tattooed this on himself, he tattoos the fact of the license plate number that is Teddy. So technically he could go without killing any other John G's after this movie is over. Do you feel that when this movie is over, like an hour later that we don't see, he actually gets that tattoo saying, I did it, and then it becomes the end of his search?
You know, interestingly, with all the times I've seen the film, I don't know that I've ever thought of that. I don't know. I guess I kind of doubt it. I mean, I think that even if he didn't realize it immediately after he killed the Joey Pants character, that, you know, he really has nothing without this search. And I don't know, maybe he goes and gets that license plate tattoo removed. Maybe he keeps looking. I have trouble believing that his characters, that he's ever going to stop, really. As sad as it is, I don't know, I just don't see it ever happening. I don't know. It's hard because even if he does get that tattoo, even if he does stop, that's hardly a happy ending for the guy. But yeah, I don't know. I can't see it going that way, I guess. What about you?
As I said, I kind of see logically that he would get that tattoo because even if he forgot to do it the next hour or 10 minutes or whatever, the rest of his life would be an endless search where he wouldn't actually get any more quote unquote revenge because he has the fact on his thigh of the license plate.
The license plate.
So yeah, no one else would fit the John G that he has created for himself at this point.
That's true, but I think you also have to remember, I mean, he's certainly lied to himself, and that's something else I love about the movie is that all throughout you see Carrie Ann Moss and Joey Pantoliano lying to Lenny and using his condition to manipulate him, and you get so disgusted by it, you know, how could they do this to this guy? And then of course at the end of the film you realize that he also does it. He also takes advantage of his own condition and the knowledge that he will forget to manipulate himself into killing someone. So I certainly don't think that Leonard's above, I mean, he basically says it in the voiceover at the end, he's not above lying to himself to make himself happy, you know? So I don't know, maybe he gets that tattoo, maybe he gets it removed. It's hard to say. Maybe he's had hundreds of tattoos with hundreds of license plates on his thighs over the God knows how long it's been. I don't know. You're right. Logically, that's what he should do, but I mean, the character doesn't really operate on logic at this point.
That's completely true. Coming back to you and your experience as a movie lover, after introducing yourself to this film, did you feel that there was a change in the movies that you looked forward to watching?
Yeah, definitely. As I said, I think that this film really, it made me realize that films could be more than just entertainment, that they could really challenge you. And this idea that the kind of the form of the film, you know, the form and the function, you know, that this narrative structure is not only cool and unique, but it's also integral to a character's thought process. It must have been shortly after I saw Memento that the Prestige was released. I think the first Nolan film that I'd technically seen was Batman Begins, but I didn't know who he was, and I remember really liking Batman Begins, but it certainly wasn't a important film to me at the time. But I remember seeing The Prestige in cinemas and loving it and think it was fantastic, and that's a film certainly that rewards repeat viewings as well. But you know, definitely, I can't think if I immediately went out and tried to find just like a bunch of non-linear films or a bunch of Guy Pearce films or something like that. I don't think it was quite like that. Not that I can recall. I think certainly for those couple of years afterwards, I would try and look for, keep my eyes open for films from that book, from the 1001 Movies book. But I think it wasn't even so much that it would change the movies I would look for, but it would change how I watched a movie and I guess maybe it ruined movies for me in a way because I think that was almost the birth of my like critical impulses in that I'd watch a film and would think, you know, it's not bad, but it really isn't trying on the same level that Memento is trying or that a film like Memento is trying. So certainly has affected that. And I think to this day, I still love Christopher Nolan. You know, at that time, unfortunately, there weren't that many I couldn't go back and look through all of his filmography because there was really only Following, which wasn't really available to me. Batman Begins, Insomnia, which I did track down and like, I like Insomnia. I think it's definitely one of his less interesting films. Yeah, I don't know. It's, on the other hand, I guess that's been good because we've been able to, I've been able to kind of grow up with Nolan films and be able to really, you know, anticipate each one of his new films and watch him develop, like see that development from film to film, in his style and approach.
While it's an obvious point for us to continually be mentioning, his name, Christopher Nolan, and through his canon, there is a sense throughout the internet and a lot of the people within our little blogging community who are all in love with films that we have this association with certain filmmakers. It almost feels, and every once in a while I get this feeling where I'm annoyed, not in a horribly negative way, as to when names that don't come under this quote unquote perfect director list, that we've created for ourselves, which include the names like Christopher Nolan, like Stanley Kubrick, like Alfred Hitchcock. And if your name isn't in that list, your movie doesn't deserve to have the kind of respective tone that we would have with those names. Do you ever wonder as to, do you ever think about why it is that we have this weird association with directors? And I mean, a film is made by 5,000 people. How have we decided to put everything on the head of this one man or woman?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a question that a lot of people have, like, they've been arguing about, I guess, since, you know, the auteur theory, and I'm not going to try and I guess totally deconstruct that. I guess in terms of categorization, which the internet loves and bloggers tend to love, it's just easier to associate, to categorize films by their directors as opposed to their kind of casting agents or what have you. And I definitely think, be it Nolan or Hitchcock or Kubrick or whatever, there are definitely, you know, stylistic, things that come from the director. And even if it's just through his recurring collaboration with, you know, the people he works with, you know, his cinematographer, I think he used Wally Pfister, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, but he's used him on pretty much all of his films. And, certainly there's both a growth, but also a consistency in the cinematography. And I guess we can attribute that to Nolan and his collaboration with someone. So, as to why we do that, I don't know. I think it's just how it's always been done, I guess. And we tend to think of the director as the person with the most influence on a film. And I don't know, they probably do in a lot of cases, most cases. So I guess that's why we do it. In terms of who makes it onto a hallowed list and who doesn't, look, I mean, I think that Nolan is an excellent filmmaker. He's made a lot of really great films. I think, the reaction to Nolan varies. And I think you have a lot of people who, because of his involvement in the Dark Knight franchise, which is obviously an absolutely beloved franchise amongst film geeks and geeks in general, you do sometimes get that horrible internet reaction where, you know, the first critic who writes a negative review of the new Batman film gets death threats, and that there has to be this groupthink, everyone has to love it. And I think that's kind of a shame, and it almost makes me embarrassed to say Christopher Nolan is my favorite filmmaker or one of my favorite filmmakers, because you don't want it kind of associated with that fanboyism, because I feel that I can justify saying that Christopher Nolan is my favorite director for these highfalutin, highbrow reasons, not just the fact that he made an awesome Batman movie, you know, while he did make an awesome Batman movie, and I love the Batman movies. At the same time, I think that there are some kind of at the other end, at the kind of film snobbish end, which you also see on the internet a lot, the people who say, you know, oh, Christopher Nolan's not that great. He just makes, like, you know, he makes blockbusters. You know, Inception was really dumbed down for people. and, you know, plot holes in The Dark Knight Rises galore. And I think that that's all true. And I think that there are definitely moments, say, in his recent films and, say, Inception that, I mean, on one level, Inception is very complex, certainly for a, certainly by summer blockbuster standards, Inception is the smartest, one of the smartest films we've seen in years. At the same time, when you compare it to something like Memento or The Prestige, there's definitely more hand-holding, more explaining what is going on to the audience, I think. I don't know. Do I wish that that wasn't in there? Yes, but I think that he... I don't know. I think that people who tend to go highbrow and just dismiss blockbusters outright probably just as foolish and just as close-minded to me as the people who just blindly adore The Dark Knight and won't hear a bad word to say about that film. I think that what Nolan does is makes films that are simultaneously exciting. I mean, especially certainly now. I mean, it doesn't really apply to Memento, but his later filmography, he makes films that are simultaneously fantastic, eye-popping blockbusters that are, look visually incredible and should please a crowd in the same way that, you know, something like a Michael Bay film pleases a crowd and gets butts in seats, but at the same time have rich characters, have complicated narratives, films that make you think, films that are ambiguous. And I think that that's why he's such a strong director and deserves to be in that kind of high canon that we hold him.
Okay, well, I guess the last question I really want to ask you, we've talked about Christopher Nolan's progression as a filmmaker and the films that he's made, for whichever reasons they've shifted into the blockbuster canon that, as we mentioned, do you feel that if Memento were not his film from 2000, if it was the movie we were looking forward to in 2014, do you feel that it would be any different than it was in its original release?
You mean our anticipation of it, or would it be more... Do you think, as in, do I think the actual text of the film would be different, or do I think that our reaction to it would be different?
Both.
Well, I think that if the film... Look, I think if that he just released Memento tomorrow, and it was the same film, I think you'd have lots of people very surprised and very disappointed that this was the new film from the maker of the Dark Knight trilogy, because it's certainly smaller scale. It's not an action film. It doesn't have that crowd-pleasing thing. Certainly, I don't think that I would be disappointed by it. I don't care whether a filmmaker makes a big film or a small film, as long as it's a good film, and I think that Memento is undoubtedly a good film. In terms of, I wonder what the film would be like if he was only getting around to telling the story now with all his fine-tuned techniques and blockbuster experience. I mean, I guess the film would probably have a bigger budget. I don't know. I guess I can't imagine him wanting to go back. I mean, his films have gotten progressively bigger, and I believe his next film is a science fiction kind of space epic. So I've got to imagine that that's going to be even bigger in scale than Inception or The Dark Knight Rises. I don't know. I kind of don't imagine him. I find it very hard to imagine him making a film like Memento anymore. Which is, I guess, a little bit disappointing, but also not. As I said, I don't care whether the film's big or little, as long as it's good. And I think that it seems like as a filmmaker, he's more interested in telling these grand epic tales now than he is these smaller, more noirish ones. So I guess it's very hard for me to say. At the same time, another thing that I really like about Nolan, and it's something that I feel was a little lacking from The Dark Knight Rises, one of the reasons I have issues with that film, but I think it's certainly something I think is fantastic about The Dark Knight and about Inception, is that even as these films get bigger and bigger in scale, and the stakes are bigger, and the size of the screen is bigger, you know, he's shooting in IMAX, I think that he manages to mostly maintain a remarkable kind of emotional intimacy in the characters. To me, the best things about The Dark Knight aren't, you know, the car chase or even kind of Heath Ledger's performance, but it's like the journey, this tragic relationship between Harvey Dent and Bruce Wayne and Rachel Dawes, and watching Dent sort of fall, I think is really emotionally powerful. You know, the ending of that film, where he confronts, Gary Oldman's character and Batman in this burnt out warehouse where the woman he loved was killed, I think is heartbreaking. And the same thing in Inception, while it's a fantastic spectacle with great action, the thing that really keeps me invested in that film is DiCaprio's desire to get back to his children and his relationship with his wife. And there's that scene where he has to kind of let her go that really, you know, breaks my heart every time. And so I think that I hope that going forward, I would be happy. I'd be thrilled if the films continue to get bigger and bigger, as long as they do keep that kind of emotional intimacy. And I mean, an intimacy that was present in Memento. I mean, that the emotional journey of his character is so important, and it's so tragic. And it's why that scene that we mentioned before with him lying with his wife with the "I did it" tattoo is so, so bittersweet, because you really care about this character. So I don't know. I think that that's, I haven't really answered your question, but, yeah, you see what I mean? You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. It's definitely a Sophie's Choice kind of question, which I'm always interested in hearing, because the truth of it is that logically, as we see the Nolan name, the Nolan brand become bigger and bigger, we see studios are more and more willing to write him a blank check to say,
yeah,
I have no issue with whatever you're going to make, because I trust your name regardless of what crazy corner of your mind you take us to. We'll be able to produce a financially viable product.
And that's what's so fantastic is that, I mean, they have talked about the reason he made Dark Knight Rises is so, you know, they gave him permission to make Inception. And I think that, yeah, that's true. So, and I, in one way, I kind of hope that he keeps making blockbusters, because there are so few blockbusters these days that I want to go and see. Do you know what I mean? Like, so few studio summer films that I'm really excited about, because I know that they're just going to be the product of the studio and they're going to be totally generic and completely bloated with CGI and terrible acting by, you know, pop stars or whoever. Nolan, I have total faith in, and again, he's got so much power at this point, that, yeah, he really can. He has that ability to write a blank check, and so few people are making completely original, blockbusters these days. And I think that the summer landscape, the Hollywood landscape, would be a lot grimmer if you didn't have Christopher Nolan working in that studio. So I guess on that level, I actually want him to keep making blockbusters, because there are any number of art house directors that I can follow with interest. You know what I mean? But there are very few films that I want to go see at the multiplex. But Christopher Nolan is certainly making them. But at the same time, if he decided that he was going to take a break from blockbusters and go and make a really small film, you know, go do a Joss Whedon and follow up The Dark Knight Rises with some film he shot at his house, I'd be totally okay with that too. I mean, I don't think that Nolan, although I had issues with The Dark Knight Rises, and I've had issues with really all his films to an extent, he hasn't let me down yet. And I certainly, they could announce any film, you know, he could sign on to have done the next Transformers film, or, you know, he could do a partnership with, you know, Harmony Korine and make Trash Humpers 2. You know, there's nothing, there's nothing, I don't think, that they could announce as his next film that I wouldn't be excited to see. Because I think he has proven himself with original properties, and he's also proven himself with, the Batman series and existing properties. So yeah, until he really stuffs it up,
he's got pretty much my undivided kind of faith and full attention.
Me and my co-host are betting on how long it'll take for that fall to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a matter of time. There aren't many directors with a perfect run. I think for some critics, for some bloggers, it was probably The Dark Knight Rises, you know, plot holes everywhere.
No. We're talking about complete and utter.
A complete and utter fail when he just makes it terrible.
Like no one can defend the movie failure.
I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a movie that... that's not true. I mean, I don't think there are many films that are indefensible. So, I don't know, I guess I just hope he continues to make interesting films, you know, even if it's not a film I like, I hope it's a film that I'm, you know, I'd much rather an interesting failure or a controversial failure or a one that makes you think a little bit, even if I don't like it. I kind of just hope he doesn't sort of sell out would be my one thing. But I have no reason to think that he will. So, yeah. I don't know. Hopefully it doesn't happen for a long time. If it doesn't, you know, hopefully he just makes another couple of great films and then retires, you know, with an unblemished filmography.
We can only hope for so much. Anyways, I'd like to thank you so much, Mr. Tom Clift, for joining us. You know, there's only so few times I get to talk to movie critics who are so renowned. They get to be quoted in trailers.
I know that was good. That was good timing. That was pretty cool. I would. You know, I haven't been quoted in trailers. I've been quoted in trailer. So you can, I'll be sure to announce it to the internet when it happens again, but I think it could be a while. But yeah, that was definitely a cool experience.
Yeah, so thanks so much for talking to me.
No, it was my pleasure. I'm always happy to talk about movies, especially something like Memento, where I think it's a film I love and there's so much you can talk about.
So yeah, that was the episode. I hope you really enjoyed it. I really dig talking to Tom. I don't think I mentioned this in the beginning, but I met Tom when I went to TIFF last year. And, like, to me, Tom was always this guy with an alien face hugger on his face, because that was his Twitter avatar until the first day of TIFF. He's like, holy crap, I should take this off so people know what I look like. So that when I go up to them, they don't think I'm some murderer who's trying to say that I am this Tom Clift person on the internet. He just came off as like one of the funniest people ever, and like I was just astounded. But anyways, I hope I get to meet up with Tom sometime soon. Who knows when that's ever gonna happen? He's all the way in Australia, but who knows? Maybe I'll find my way to Australia one day. But anyways, you should follow him on Twitter. He is Tom_Clift on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Gman Reviews. The podcast you can get over at gmanreviews.com. You can also subscribe through iTunes. I like to listen to it through Pocket Cast because I'm an Android guy. I'm not much for Apple. But regardless, if you're using iTunes, as I said at the beginning, I'm going to say it again because I really want it to happen. Like, go vote, go review, go rate the podcast over there, and go subscribe, go enjoy, and please share and enjoy. I'm about to say enjoy again. Please share and love this podcast. Or don't. I mean, it's your choice. The next episode of this podcast will be up on April 13th, Sunday, April 13th. So I look forward to you guys listening to me talk to someone else then. Thanks so much and have a good day, guys. Big mistake. Now we're gonna pay and pay the sentence of our lives. Can't believe I'm asking you to go. We used what we could to get the things we want. Each other on the way, I guess you
I've done.